You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Logroño.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. I'm back on the Vuelta a España in place of Richard Moore, who's gone home. His Vuelta is over. He's not going to make it to Madrid. I'm not going to make it to Madrid either. I'm bailing out at the top of the Angliru on Saturday.
You're not making up the Angliru. You are making up the Angliru.
I'm going to make it up the Angliru, Daniel. I'm with Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel. Good to see you.
Hello, chaps.
You well?
Yeah, strong.
Always come good in the final week, don't you, Daniel?
Yeah, we've got to keep pace with these young bucks that we have on the podcast now. Fran Reyes.
Indeed.
He's taking the average age down. I already take the average age down on the podcast significantly, but Fran brings it down even more significantly.
I'm not sure you understand averages there, Daniel.
Seven years? 8 years? 9 years? Anyway.
Get out of town.
Well, I am.
Hang on.
Anyway.
And Fran Reyes. Good to see you, Fran.
Good to see you back.
Where are we, Fran?
Well, we are in Logroño, great capital city of La Rioja, the region of wine here in Spain.
But, Fran, it's not really surrounded by Rioja vineyards, is it? I mean, it's the start of Rioja country.
Yeah, we could say that. I mean, it's the deepest part of La Rioja, where the Rioja wine is actually produced. Also, in the nearby province of Vitoria, there are some Rioja wine trees.
Wine trees? Vine
trees?
Yeah, with a lot of bottles.
I can confirm Fran hasn't been on the Rioja. I had quite a few glasses of Rioja last night.
A little tasting session.
We found a lovely street in Logroño here, which was all tapas bars. It was absolutely fantastic, out till reasonably late because it was a rest day. And some of the Rioja was really very nice, and one the barman told us was flavoured with whiskey, because the oak barrels previously are used to store whiskey and then cleaned out, and then the wine goes in there and it takes on a slight whiskey edge. I don't know whether he's having me on there. Does that sound plausible, Daniel?
It's plausible. I'm not sure I approve, but anyway.
Well, anyway, should we talk about the Vuelta a España, which resumed today with stage 16? It was a time trial. It went from the motor racing circuit at Nevada here to Logroño, 40 kilometres, and Chris Froome has strengthened his grip on the red jersey by winning the stage. An impressive performance. He now leads overall by 1:58 from Vincenzo Nibali. The other ride of the day was Wilco Kelderman, I think, of Team Sunweb. Finished second on the stage, 29 seconds down on Froome. Continuing Team Sunweb's fantastic season of Grand Tours. Tom Dumoulin, of course, won the Giro. Then they had both jerseys at the Tour de France, with Michael Matthews winning the green jersey, Warren Barguil winning the King of the Mountains. And now Kelderman looks pretty well set to finish on the podium, although he will have his work cut out perhaps against Ilnur Zakarin, who's 27 seconds behind him, and who knows, maybe even Miguel Angel Lopez or Alberto Contador in the final mountain stages will gain enough time to make a late run at the podium. Bad performances today, or probably par performances, but big time loss for the likes of Michael Woods, 3 minutes 40, Luis Menquez, 3:42, Esteban Chavez, 4 minutes and 1 second. So really, Chris Froome was talking yesterday in his press conference about hoping to extend his lead, and he's done that quite significantly, hasn't he, Daniel?
He has, and a commanding time trial win for Froome. He hasn't been prolific in time trials recently. In fact, the last one he won was at the Vuelta last year, but in the very top company against the very best opponents, he hasn't been quite the rider in time trials that he was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But today, certainly very commanding. Interesting, the strategy that he adopted. He went out quite slowly, relatively slowly, and sort of literally almost went through the gears as the time trial went on, and was gaining a lot of time in the final section. It's been a hallmark of this Vuelta performance by Froome, this kind of calculating nature. We spoke to him yesterday, we heard from him yesterday about how he thought it would be a mistake to go really, really deep today, or go way beyond his limit or anyone else's is his limit. At the risk of compromising their performance tomorrow at Los Machucos. And I think Froome is just, he's a real sort of master now of calculating his effort, measuring his effort. And, you know, this is a phase I think all of the great or the very good Grand Tour riders eventually progress to, where they, you know, they know exactly how their body's going to react to every challenge, every situation. And, you know, they don't feel the need for any big kind of huge attacks anymore, or to even follow their instincts at times. They really know how to dose every droplet of energy.
Well, we were at Chris Froome's rest day press conference at his hotel on the other side of town here. So let's hear a little bit about what Chris Froome said. Obviously, this was from before the time trial, but it's quite interesting in light of what you've just said to hear Chris Froome's thoughts yesterday.
I mean, obviously we've got Angliru on Saturday, which is going to be a massive way to finish off the GC battle of this year's Vuelta. We've also got Los Machucos, which is the day after tomorrow, after the time trial. And that's going to be one, I mean, not as long as Angliru, but certainly the gradients are right up there. I mean, I think pitches of over 20%, those are going to be two very critical stages. And I think, in a way, tomorrow's time trial, whoever leaves absolutely everything on the road will pay for it on Los Machucos the day after. So it's a really tough final week, and I think every day has got to be ridden thinking about what's coming up as well. And the memories from 2011, I mean, it just that was the day that I basically got the all clear from the team to go for it. Brad was fading on the slopes of Angliru, and I still felt good and basically got the green light there to push on and go for it. So, I mean, quite cool memories from back then, but it's a grueling climb. I hope I have the same legs that I had back in 2011. I would say Zonkolan in the Giro is the toughest climb I've ever ridden, but Angliru is definitely up there. Probably the next toughest.
Chris, in terms of the way you planned your season with the Tour first and the Vuelta second, obviously nobody's done this job this way around before.
Yeah.
And do you feel that you've got it right in terms of having enough left for the last week, or is it still a kind of bit of a journey into the unknown?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, every year, it's a bit of an unknown, having done the Tour first. But I do believe after, I don't know how many years we've tried now, 4 or 5 years to try and get this right, we've got a lot closer this year, and certainly we've come here with a lot more purpose, and I think we're seeing that now. I mean, I haven't been in the leader's jersey of the Vuelta since 2011, so I think we definitely got something right this year, but certainly not gonna bank on anything just yet. There's a lot of big racing to come before we reach Madrid.
Well, Chris Froome there talking about the danger that lurks in Wednesday's stage with another very steep finish. It's on a kind of concrete road, isn't it? I'm not familiar with it. What do you know about it, Fran? Anything?
Well, it's crazy steep. Basically, a goat path. Like, a lot of uphill finishes here in the Vuelta.
It's interesting, Chris Froome made that point, as you said, Daniel, that anyone who goes deep today might pay for it tomorrow. It seems to me that was a bit of a game of bluff. He was getting that out there last night, maybe making people think twice about how they would tackle the time trial today. And as it turns out, he's gained more time. And I was thinking about this yesterday, the way he's approached these two Grand Tours. Of course, this double's never been done before with the Tour followed by the Vuelta. He looks on course to do that now. But I was thinking, if the Tour and the Vuelta were both games of Monopoly, he won the Tour de France by buying the stations and the utilities and just, you know, securing his victory that way. In the first 2 weeks of this Vuelta, he's really gone big. He's built hotels on Mayfair and Park Lane. And now in the final week of this Vuelta, I think he's just going to collect the rent.
I think it was Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the drawing room.
A completely different board game. Fran, do you have the game Monopoly in Spain?
Of course we do. And we even have a fake subpar version called Superpoli.
Superpoli, and it's based in Madrid, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Based in Madrid. Yeah. It's like the Monopoly, but quite cheaper, and the quality is way lower.
But my point is that, you know, he plotted his way around the Tour very thoughtfully. You know, he's turned the screw early in this race, and now he's in such a commanding position. He doesn't need to do very much in the final week, does he? He just needs to be careful, mark, and make sure nothing particularly untowards happens. And he's helped a lot, I think, by the fact that Miguel Angel Lopez has not done a great time trial today. So even if he does go crazy tomorrow and on the Angliru on Saturday, he's not going to pose any great threat, is he?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you said Lopez, well, you're very diplomatic, Lionel, in describing a couple of the riders' time trials. I used to have a French teacher, Mr. Mather, who if anyone slipped below 10 out of 20, the only comment on their work would be bad. And I felt like I was reminded of Mr. Mather's marking technique today when I saw some of the results for the time trial. That's really the only comment that...
Oh, Lopez has done okay. No, I mean, there. 2:34. He's probably
pretty good,
the least,
actually.
Least
pretty good,
bad
pretty
of
good.
The bad results today.
Yeah.
But, guys, I drove the course out behind two Manzano Postobon riders, and it was really interesting to actually ride the course. And what Chris Froome said about the gradually increasing steps in the first half, rising up, and then the gradually decreasing steps in the second half, made it quite a test of sort of judgment. It might have been tempting to go out too hard in that first bit and then pay for it on the downhill and flatter sections towards the end. But it was an interesting course to go and see, and we got overtaken by Bob Jungels of Quick Step at one point. He was one of the guys who might have thought about possibly winning the stage, but had a disappointing result, finished ninth on the stage, got a 20 second time penalty. Haven't managed to find out what that was for, but I imagine it was because he got stuck in so much traffic. He may well have sat behind a car or a bike or one of the Manzano Postobon riders for a bit too long, perhaps. Find out tomorrow, I guess.
It was an amazingly rolling course. When you looked at the profile in the road book, it looked like a completely flat course, and then there was actually very little flat road. They weren't steep climbs, they weren't steep descents, but I spoke to Vincenzo Nibali at the finish, and my old chum Vincenzo, we're getting on like a house on fire now.
Yeah.
I think in fact, can I even say I know that someone had a word? Anyway, he talks about the fact that, you know, for a light rider, he's a relatively light rider, he weighs 60 something kilos, the wind was whipping across the road and he was sort of being thrown around all over the shop, and you had to keep the pace very, very high to sort of prevent yourself almost derailing. And, you know, at times he was going at 60 kilometers an hour, at 70 kilometers an hour, but it was that kind of course. There were some incredibly straight roads as well. There were times when you could see 4 or 5 kilometers ahead of yourself.
Fran, Alberto Contador, when he crossed the line here in Logroño, he set the fastest time.
Yeah.
It was never going to be enough to win the stage, but a decent performance, or was that disappointing, do you think?
No. I mean, I for one haven't found any great disappointment or surprise in today's performances. I guess the circumstance of the wind that was tailwind for the most of the course, or if not tailwind, at least favorable for the riders, did make for some, let's say, predictable results. And Contador was actually a bit higher, a bit better than I expected. But yeah, that technical draw he had with Zakarin and Nibali, three of them in 2 seconds time, was pretty good performance for him, you know. And after the finish, the press and the fans were euphoric, you know, like the 100th resurrection of Alberto Contador for victory. And one of the journalists there asked Contador 3 times whether he was going to race for the podium from now on, but he was reluctant to assert that.
Was it our friend from Cadena Cope?
Nope, Onda Cero.
Cadena Ser.
Onda Cero.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Fran,
talk to us about the Spanish radio journalists. What an awesome bunch they are. There are 3 of them. Onda Cero,
Cadena Ser.
Cadena Ser.
And
they hunt in packs, but they're the most aggressive journalists I've ever seen. If there was a media scrum world championships, they would be my hot favourites for positions 1, 2 and 3.
Yeah, we have always been a country of fighters, you know, and they clearly inherited this. As I see, they fight to have what everyone else is having. They want to have Contador words because they see a bunch of people going to get Contador. If this bunch follows De La Cruz, they go after De La Cruz. But, you know, it's effectively like a wolf pack chasing fresh meat, you know. And in this case, the meat that is best served is always Alberto Contador, because Jacinto Vidarte...
Let's not talk about meat and Contador, please. Don't encourage people.
Clint Buterol, please.
Just before we move on from Contador, I mean, he's got 4 days, really, hasn't he? And really only two opportunities to win a stage and go out on a real high. You know, what are people expecting from him in these last few days?
Fireworks. Just that, you know, fireworks, attacking from far away, and maybe getting the victory in the Angliru. That would be the fairy tale ending, you know. Rather than winning the Vuelta, it would be winning the Angliru, which is considered the most legendary mountain top in Spain right now, despite the fact that it has only been holding races for, what, 20 years maybe? From 1999, if I am not mistaken. So, yeah, that would be the fairy tale ending, but it's quite difficult to see an scenario on which Alberto Contador can actually win there.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast, enabling us to be here in wonderful Logroño. It's not as warm as I was expecting. It's still fairly warm. It's not as warm as it was down in the south when I left the race. But I've been watching at home on TV, and although he's not a new name in terms of impressive results, the man of the middle week was Miguel Angel Lopez of Astana. Two stage wins, Fran. What did you make of his time trial, and what can you tell us about him?
Well, you know, the other day I was speaking to his personal masseur, some to Vicente Belda, Vicens, who told me that Miguel Angel is actually doing great this week because of two factors. First was freshness, and second was that the kind of efforts, the type of efforts that were held in the second week were exactly perfect to match his skills. He is great to do long efforts on steady courses such as these climbs to Calar Alto or
Sierra Nevada.
And because of that, he told me that probably the time trial was the stage that suited him best out of the last week. Now, Los Machucos and Angliru are too explosive of climbs to actually suit him.
There's this misconception about Colombian riders and Colombian climbers, isn't there? And I think we've talked about this with regard to Nairo Quintana before, that I remember at the start of his career, you know, people would look at, for example, the Vuelta route, and they would see these really steep climbs, and they would think, you know, it's perfect for a little guy, a mountain goat like Quintana. But actually, and this is something I spoke to Esteban Chavez about the other day, that most of the climbs in Colombia are relatively steady, incredibly long, and on wide roads. They look a lot like the climbs you kind of see in the Tour of Utah or Colorado Challenge. And then, you know, they're nothing like the climbs we see in the Vuelta. And that's reflected by the results of some of the Colombian riders here and, you know, in other races, that some of them, Lopez is one, Quintana is another, they do like the long climbs.
He's certainly been the most impressive Astana rider, though, hasn't he? I mean, Fabio Aru is a former winner of the Vuelta. He's been a real disappointment here, hasn't he?
A disappointment, but I always like to see a rider who is not in the best form and for whom things are not going particularly well, at least like cling on and continue to ride for general classification. I always feel it's a bit of a cop-out for someone like Fabio Aru to, you know, lose 30 minutes on general classification and then go for a stage win. And, you know, Romain Bardet's ridden an unusual Vuelta in that respect. He's, well, he lost time early and then he has tried to win stages. It's not worked for him. But I actually think it shows more kind of character, and it's more important for someone's career progression to do what Aru has done and sort of battle through some level of adversity, or at least, you know, struggle through in different form to, you know, still be seventh on general classification.
What do you make, by the way, about the performance of Steven Kruiswijk? Because I pretty much expected him to be on the top seven of this race, and he's quite far away from it.
I must confess, having not been here for a week, I was fairly unaware that he was even in the race, to be honest.
One of those ones.
I was thinking, as you said, Steven Kruiswijk there, I was thinking, well, he's not riding, is he? But no, he is riding. Did see him today, actually, at the start. Yeah, I mean, talk about being overshadowed by his fellow countrymen this season. You know, last year, after going so close in the Giro, you know, he looked like a real possible for the podium in a Grand Tour, and now of course Tom Dumoulin and here Wilco Kelderman are completely outshining him. And I mean, it's difficult to say, you know, what's up with him, but clearly it's not going to plan for him. And that team are really struggling to pick out anything else, aren't they?
AG2R.
Yes, Daniel. Well, they started two men light today, didn't they? Because on the rest day, some footage emerged on social media. You might be able to shed some light on how this happened, Daniel. But, yeah, Alexandre Geniez and Nico Denz of AG2R have been pulled out of the race by their team because they were filmed holding onto the team car. Was it on Sierra Nevada on Sunday?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And so out of the race.
And their team car, not the direct sportif who was guilty, but the second team car is out of the race. So AG2R have only got one team car for the remainder of the race.
Who was the sports director?
The sports director was Didier Janel, and he's still on the race. He's going to be doing various other odd jobs, but he's not allowed. Well, I presume he won't be in the first team car because that's Julien Jourdi, the first director. But yeah, they've lost their car. So, you know, if an AG2R rider gets in a break these last few days, they haven't got too many riders left. I think they've got four or five left. And Pozzovivo is out, and the two riders who have been kicked out are obviously not here anymore. But yeah, if a rider gets in a break, then they'll have a decision to make. I guess it's at their discretion whether they send a team car forward and leave their captain Bardet in the peloton unattended, unassisted, or whether they simply don't follow the break. And the same applies at the back of the race. You know, I'm sure some of the riders will be getting drops on some of these high mountains and they won't be able to assist them.
This is not without precedent, is it? Riders being kicked out of races for holding onto cars for too long. You mentioned Romain Bardet. He was kicked out of Paris-Nice, wasn't he, for doing that? Vincenzo Nibali, of course, in the Vuelta a few years ago. I mean, that was a famous example because that was a real turbocharged, you know, he's holding onto the car as it was accelerating past other riders, or at least accelerating across a gap. This is really quite different in that the riders were obviously in or off the back of the gruppetto, struggling in to make it to the finish line on a really difficult summit finish, and the footage has emerged on social media, basically on a Twitter stream, and the team has taken the action to withdraw the riders from the race on the basis that it doesn't project the right image for the team, rather than them being kicked out of the race by commissaires, because the commissaires, of course, can only act upon what they see with their own eyes or what they are told by people working within the race. I mean, it's a real dangerous precedent if we get to a stage where the footage shot on the side of the road is used to actually enforce the rules. That isn't what has happened here, but it's in a slightly grey area, isn't it? Not saying that the two AG2R riders shouldn't have been withdrawn from the race, because you're not allowed to hold on to a team car. But then again, there is an element of who's refereeing, you know, who's in charge of deciding what's fair play and what isn't fair play. And I always feel a bit iffy about this kind of thing. I've mentioned this on the podcast before about the golf tournament where it was one of the women's majors where the ball moved and the player didn't notify the officials, signed for the wrong score. Somebody watching at home on TV then phoned up the tournament and basically got a 2 or 3 stroke penalty.
Well, it happens a lot in golf.
And I kind of think, have people not got better to do than?
In this instance, the footage obviously came from another team. We don't know which team it was at the moment. I've got some ideas, but I'm not sure which team it came from. And it was leaked, and it appeared on social media, and then that started a series of events which has led to these two riders being checked out. Just on the circumstances themselves, Didier Janel said to me this morning that what happened was that he hadn't seen the two riders, so Alexandre Geniez and Nico Denz, for a while. There were groups all over the road, so this was the first time he'd seen them for a few kilometres, and they needed a drink. I think it was Geniez initially held on to the car, as a lot of riders do, just to ask for a drink and ask for information about what the time limit was likely to be and so forth and so forth. Didier Janel says that he couldn't see, he had no awareness of the second rider, almost hidden behind the first rider, holding on to the roof rack, really, wasn't he? And then the first rider, who, as I say, I think was Geniez, then started asking for a drink, and as the way that Janel put it to me was that he was really spending
really,
a lot
really thirsty.
Well, he was asking for a lot of information, or he was basically beating about the bush as regards what he was going to drink, you know, when it was going to be delivered, and all sorts of, I don't know whether he was asking for the ingredients in whatever sports
so
drink
making,
it was.
Playing for time.
He
really.
Was playing for time. Yeah. This is what Didier Janelle said, and eventually, after a few seconds, I mean, on the clip we see about 20 seconds, I think, of him holding onto the car. Janelle says to him, "Look, you've got to let go now." At which point, you know, he was still asking whether the lemon juice in the drink was freshly squeezed and whether it came from
what kind of gene they were putting.
Andalusian citrus groves. But yeah, so that is supposedly what happened. And the two riders themselves were distraught, I understand, last night. They were both in tears when they were told that they were going to be kicked out. And that's about it. I'm going to kick myself out of the podcast in a minute, Lionel, because I've got to go up down the road because someone's got to sort our reservation for dinner.
Indeed. Well, I mean, we'll let you go then, Daniel, because we're staying in the same place this evening. It looks like a very nice place.
Yeah.
Has a restaurant, so we need you to go ahead and make
sure.
It's
vitally important. I'm sure the listeners will agree.
Indeed. Well, it's good to be back, and I'll see you again tomorrow, Daniel.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you would like to get 20% off Science in Sport's products, you can go to scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, put in the code CPORG20. That's CP for Cycling Podcast, ORG, A-U-G, for August 20. I know it's September, but the code hasn't been changed yet. So if you're buying anything from Science in Sport, use that 20% discount code while you still can. I think it will change at some point soon. Now, Fran, Chris Froome was playing mind games a little bit on the rest day, suggesting that his rivals should take it easy in the time trial, just in case they were to suffer in tomorrow's stage with the steep uphill finish. But Alberto Contador made some interesting comments also about the financial health of cycling, and he's riding for Trek, a team sponsored by a bicycle manufacturer. Back in the glory days, Contador would have been one of the best paid riders in the peloton. Chris Froome, I would have thought, is one of the best paid riders now, certainly working for the team that has the biggest budget. But what were the kind of the basis of Contador's comments on the rest day?
Well, I guess basically this salary cap thing has been around for a while. You know, Jonathan Waters has been a strong advocate for this. He even did his MVA final piece of work on this very topic. And I guess the strength of Sky is right now too much for the rest of the peloton. And since they are growing increasingly frustrated by the fact that most teams can't afford to buy a roster strong enough to compete head-on with Team Sky, that's the reason why there are more voices calling for the salary cap.
Jonathan Waters, actually, he's an advocate of a budget cap, which is slightly different. Yeah. Doesn't mean that you can't pay your riders, you know, as much as you want, but the team's overall budget would be capped, which, of course, would change the makeup of a team's roster, and arguably it would stop Sky from being able to bring in so many top-class riders, paying them better as super domestiques, if you want to call them that, than they would perhaps get at other teams, and enabling themselves to build a roster where they have a rider like Wout Poels here as their kind of second man working for Chris Froome, I'm sure, on a very good salary that may exceed what he would get as a team leader elsewhere.
Yeah, but you know, it's not all about talent recruitment. You know, of course you can buy a Galactico team and expect it to be the best of the world. But if you don't get to motivate the riders, to train them properly, to prepare them for the goals of the season, and keep them together when they are working towards them, you are not going to succeed anyway. So I guess in the Spanish TV, they are obsessed with this thing of Sky being the biggest budget team, you know, and they are using it, throwing this argument away every time they see the Sky riders pulling from the peloton as a way to justify how dominant they are. But I think but there is way more to it than the fact that they pay big salary and have the biggest talent pool in the world tour.
I mean, certainly at the motor racing circuit today, they had their big race hub set up, two-story building. It's the first time I've actually seen it. I've seen photographs, of course, but I had a look inside. I didn't go inside, but I know Richard went in to interview a couple of people last week. I mean, it looks, because we were there at a motor racing circuit, it looks like something from Formula One or MotoGP, and that's obviously where the idea has come from. But then when you look at the team buses next door, you know, they look quite small by comparison. And I was on the Dimension Data bus today, and it's a nice bus, nothing particularly wrong with it, but it's not kitted out in quite the same luxury way as the Orica bus or the Sky bus or one or two other buses. There's a real hierarchy of how the riders are supported away from the race, just in those, you know, the surroundings that they're in, I guess.
You know, about the Sky Hub that was being set up today for the riders to warm up in front of the public. They were standing on a stage like 2 meters above the people, so they all could see them. And I could hear some Spanish fans making jokes about throwing them peanuts as they were warming up. So, yeah, that kind of worked, but not that much, you know. It was impressive, but definitely no awe-inspiring.
So the Spanish were almost like zoo animals. They're there to be looked at. A bit like, going to look at the animals in the zoo. Yeah. Well, Fran, you spoke to Lucha Guechelena of Trek.
Yes.
Let's hear from him on the subject of salary caps.
Yeah, let's hear from him. Quite very interesting comments about the revenue streams.
Well, it's a difficult discussion. I mean, in the business model of professional sports, there's always a salary cap. If we analyze what's going on especially in the American sports that are always considered the benchmark for the pro sport, you need a salary cap simply to keep the competitivity between teams. But it's working when the system is all set up for that. So there's a draft, there's a system to allow the weakest team to hire the best talent and not just focusing that on the high payroll. So I think that the salary cap can work in cycling when the business model is that and where their share revenue for all the stakeholders. By the way, I think that in actual cycling it will be difficult to apply, even if it could be a good point to discuss, because it's clear that if the budget are start to assuming a figure that is too different between the low budget team and the higher budget team, then clearly the competition is getting too much managed by money, and that can create after a while a boring system. But we all know that in professional sport the economy is what making the difference, and the financial wise are making the difference. So I think that is a good way to chase, but always keeping in mind that is the business model that can change, not just put it in a salary cap on the actual business model.
We always speak about revenue sharing, thinking of the TV rights that organizers do sell and basically own. But do you think that this should also happen with the commercial structure in terms of sponsorship shares and so on?
I guess that a business model is pretty simple, as in the other professional sport. Organizers, teams are making the business. So that are the two stakeholders that for the most need to discuss and create events that are allowing both to gain money and make things better. And on this kind of system, then you can create a salary cap that allows to keep control and keep the competition active on the way to have a balance between competitors. And I think that's the only solution. If you want to put a salary cap, that's the business model. If this actual business model stays, then we need to see what the team together can do to try to find revenue and to avoid that the team are folding year by year.
Well, Fran, Alberto Contador, one of the star names of Spanish cycling, but not riding for a Spanish team. How would you sum up the strength of the Spanish peloton at the moment in terms of the teams? Because we were talking about sort of 20 years ago or 18 years ago when the Angliru first appeared in the Vuelta. And back in those days, you know, Banesto, Onsay, I think were still just about around and had been around for a long while as a real super team. In fact, they were one of the first teams, if not the first team, to have a big bus that the riders could go in. Everyone else just had team cars, and then a few got camper vans, but Onsay were the first with a big bus. So they kind of led the way in many senses. Movistar, of course, have got huge backing from a telecommunications company that has interests all around the world. But there isn't the second, third, fourth big Spanish team. It's not as strong as it used to be. What's the attitude in Spain at the moment?
Well, to be honest, the mood right now is quite upbeat. Okay, for since 2013, since the demise of Euskaltel Euskadi, the mood was pessimistic because the Spanish peloton went down to four teams. One World Tour Movistar, one Pro Conti, Caja Rural, and two continental teams, Euskadi and Burgos BH. And we could hardly see any new project on the horizon. Luckily, this summer, there have been some positive news. The Polartec Comera team, continental team set up by Alberto Contador, strong rumors of Burgos BH, the current continental team, stepping up to Pro Continental, which are great news that will probably be confirmed by the protagonist tomorrow at the start village of Villa Diego. And then we have Landa, of course, Mikel Landa. He introduced yesterday his new project of taking over the Fundación Euskadi, which is the structure that originally ran the Euskaltel Euskadi team and was now surviving as an under 23 team. They were struggling for budget, and Mikel Landa stepped in to save it.
Well, you spoke to Mikel Landa, of course, currently with Sky, moving to Movistar next season. And let's hear what he said about his plans to develop this Basque development team.
I born in the Fundación Euskadi. They give me all I need during my career to arrive where I am now. And they were in a bad situation, and I decided to help them because I want the best, no, for the young riders. I want to give them all I have. So that's why I did.
What's your project for this Fundación Euskadi?
At the moment, we don't have an idea, because we work a lot to save the Fundación Euskadi, and in the coming days we are going to starting working in the coming years, no? Maybe continental, maybe under amateur, so we will see.
Okay, so when are we going to find out the answer to that big question, whether the Fundación Euskadi / Mikel Landa will have a continental team next year?
When? I don't know, maybe in 2 weeks, maybe in three. No, we start working, no, and we need an answer, no, in 2-3 weeks, because we are in September and the riders, they need to know, no, their future.
But who or what companies supports you in this project?
At the moment, Fundación Euskadi have partners. That's a very important part in this foundation. But also we started speaking with Orbea. They always had been with Fundación Euskadi, and I think they can be a very important part in this project.
What about Etxeondo? Because I see people from Etxeondo here too.
Yeah, they can be also. No, we speak with them. They are also interested, no, because this is a vast project, so maybe they help us also.
We've seen projects from other riders and so on, and some of them do invest their personal money in their projects for young riders. Do you understand, or do you intend to invest your own money on this?
At this moment, I'm not going to do. We want to have new sponsors, and maybe also all the sponsors, not to support us. But of course, if we need more money that we have, I will put it.
Mikel told me that this was actually the first time since the Tour de France that he had spoken English.
Interesting. His English is very good.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we'll see how that developed. Of course, Euskaltel Euskadi was a Basque team in its entirety, wasn't it? You had to be Basque to ride for them. I think they had a French rider, but he was a French Basque. I can't remember who that was. That was
Pierre Cassot and Romain Sicard.
That's right, Romain Sicard, of course. So, I mean, there's such a such a tradition of cycling in the Basque Country, isn't there? And we're not quite going into it, are we, in the next few days, or are we?
No, we are not. Unfortunately, we are not.
We're bypassing this year, aren't we? We're going across Burgos and then into Asturias for the final stage before Madrid.
It's a shame because we are so close to Vitoria, to Alava, and we could have seen all those beautiful trees with wine bottles hanging from the branches, but
Asturias is dramatic in its own way, isn't it? And I'm certainly looking forward to visiting the Angliru on Saturday.
Well, can I make a couple of final points on this Basque cycling scene? They are currently, with Mikel Pratlanda, stepping in to try and set up a continental team for the Fundación Euskadi. At least, at the very least, he's saving it, and he's speaking of a serious project to actually set up a continental team the very next year. There are two fully Basque projects overlapping at this moment: the Fundación Euskadi of Mikel Landa and the Euskadi Murias team, run by Jon Odriozola, former Banesto, Kelme, and some Italian team rider, that has been running a continental team for 3 years, and next year we'll have a pro-continental one. Both teams ride Orbia, but I understand that Orbia is way more interested in supporting Landa's team than Odriozola's.
Orbia, of course, is the Basque bicycle manufacturing company, a very famous name in bicycle manufacturing and synonymous with the Basque country, isn't it?
Exactly. And you want news I just received? I'm just going to throw them at you.
Go on.
You know, and see how you react to them. What Cannondale Draypack rider has announced his retirement?
Who is that?
Andrew Tolansky.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they are telling me in WhatsApp. If that's not true, we are going to edit this out. But if it's true...
Oh, I see. Is that how it's working now?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Oh, well, this is journalism now.
If we all have the option to edit out our mistakes, I mean, it makes a whole different podcast. Well, that's a very interesting one. Has that just happened in the last 10, 15 minutes?
Yes, it has.
Very interesting. Well, we'll try and follow up on that tomorrow. Of course, the whole team is struggling at the moment. They're trying to raise this funding to plug the gap left by a sponsor that has pulled out. Their whole team is in doubt for next year, but we'll follow that.
What if I told you that rumors in the grapevine say that the team has found the funding?
Well, Jonathan Voorters has been saying for a few days, watch this space, he's very close to getting something. But I think until they announce it...
Exactly.
Well, there we are.
Sadly, we are not doing a speculation, only facts, I don't know.
Well, as you know, yeah, I hate speculation. Well, we'll follow up on all of that tomorrow. We better wrap it up there, Fran, because we've got to drive quite a long way this evening to get quite a transfer this evening before tomorrow's Stage 17. So we shall hit the road and... If you want to listen to something on Wednesday morning, or indeed Wednesday afternoon, the next episode of Kilometer Zero will be released for Friends of the Podcast, and it's about the Dimension Data team, who are down to three riders. They've been wiped out, really, by a virus that first hit Ben King right at the start of the race, and one by one their riders are pulled out. There's only three of them left. I spoke to one of them, Lachlan Morton. I spoke to a couple of their sports directors as well about how morale is. They seem, the three that are left, Igor Anton and Jacques Janser van Rensburg, seem in reasonable spirits. Morton seemed in reasonable spirits, but I wanted to know what it's like when you lose two-thirds of your roster and you've still got the best part of a week to go until Madrid. So that will be tomorrow's Kilometre Zero. Other than that, Fran, we will be back, hopefully with Daniel again, tomorrow. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Looking forward to hear your Kilometre Zero.